Filmmaker Friedrich Moser is on a crusade for truth. His new film, How to Build a Truth Engine, features investigators from the fields of technology, journalism, folklore, and neuroscience who show that if you hack the information feed, you can hack somebody's mind.
Anything that happened in the world would become the cornerstone of a new conspiracy story, like a small story. And suddenly you have this web of conspiracy stories that grow together. And then on top of that, you see the formation of a real conspiracy. And that's the conspiracy that led to January the 6th and the Capitol riot, because a lot of people who were there, and I'm not talking about the Proud Boys, and I'm not talking about those, but like normal, ordinary people, a lot of people who were there genuinely believed that they were really there to save democracy. So their feedback loop system of, of the model of the world that is in the mind and the real world had been cut off by relying exclusively on these online communities for information. And that's a really dangerous thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and my partner in crime and co-host is Scoop Sweeney. Our guest today is Friedrich Moser, who is a producer and a director. He's known for documentaries like A Good American and The Maze, and his upcoming How to Build a Truth Engine, which is a fascinating film, and is much of what we're talking about today is going to be based on that film. Just before we started, though, we were talking about conspiracy theories and how people get drawn into them, and Fritz was about to tell us a story. You want to go ahead and get back to that?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be at your podcast and your show. Please.
Thank you.
Don't mind my Austrian accent. I try to be as American as I can possibly be in my pronunciation. So I think the starting point that we had in our conversation here was that actually really smart people end up becoming conspiracy theorists. And the question is why and how? And this has got a lot to do with the film that I made, which of course is not the kind of creation of my mind, but I bumped into some scientists who have been working on that, mostly at UCLA, but also at UC Berkeley, and some journalists who are working at the New York Times visual investigations team, who also have got a background in technology or in other fields like political science or history. And one of the interesting things is how actually do people fall into these traps of conspiracy theories? And if you are an investigative journalist and you are exposed to conspiracies, like real conspiracies, time after time after time, at some point you start seeing conspiracies everywhere, because that's the way how your mind is getting primed. And that happened to a dear friend of mine from Germany, who did a really important and good piece about corruption at a major international institution. And when then the pandemic hit, he totally drifted into the COVID denier groupings, which was very weird because he was this very sharp mind. But these kind of things are happening. And the same also to Bill Binney, who was the protagonist in my film, A Good American, which he used to be the technical director of NSA. And he kind of was leading this kunk works at NSA for a long time to basically come up with solutions to tackle the digital age. And he was a brilliant mind, but he at some point saw the deep state and these kind of things everywhere, and has now become a deep state conspiracy theorist. And it's not because these people are dumb or so. I think these are tricks that our mind is playing us when we are getting exposed to certain patterns over and over and over again. And that's something that I'm showing in my film, how this works and why it works so quickly and so efficiently.
So I wonder to what extent your film was an investigation and to what extent it was something where you kind of knew what you were going for. I mean, typically a film like a fictional narrative film is scripted and then you film the script and there can be some improvisation. But I get the sense in your film that you didn't really know exactly what all the answers were when you started, and that by the end you had a pretty good idea how the mind does what it does to draw people into these conspiracy theories. Is that correct?
That's totally correct. I had no idea about what I was about to encounter when I started out with this film. I basically started based on the work that some of my friends were doing. And one is a researcher at the university, at the Technical University of Graz in Austria. And he got involved in a project which tried to come up with ways how to flag fake news on Facebook and other social media platforms. And the other one was a software engineer, and he had developed a metadata graphing tool to fight back against the Islamic State, or against the support network of the Islamic State in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland at the height of the terror wave that we had in Europe between 2015, you know, with Charlie Hebdo and the Paris massacre, Bataclan, and up to Berlin in 2017. So this second guy, Jan, he got asked by a European government that I cannot disclose, whether his software would work also to fight back disinformation, because that government was very worried that Russian disinformation agents would actually meddle in national and European elections. And his answer was, actually not, because we are graphing metadata. So basically, we are graphing the relationship of the people behind conspiracy theories or behind disinformation, but we cannot actually tackle the content. So he started out to find a way to tackle the content. But unfortunately for him, in 2020, he died from a heart attack unexpectedly. And so for me, I then, because I was covering his work and his basically the development of his work and the development of his software, I had to find a new story. And I found it in America, I found it in California. And this was the story of StoryMiner, which is a narrative extraction graphing tool that basically graphs the relationship between all the players in a narrative. So basically all the actors, so people who act, and all the actants, which are places or ideas that are acted upon. And I found this a very interesting thing, because through the graphing of these relationships between all these players in narratives, they could determine if a narrative looked fishy, if it looked like stitched together, artificially put together, or if it was like a genuine narrative. And if it looked like artificially stitched together, you would have like very weak connections between two different points of these networks, instead of having a multidimensional network there. And that gave a hint that probably this could be a conspiracy theory. So this was like the thing that I started with, that I discovered actually on my Facebook feed, I will talk about this later, because my Facebook feed is full of scientists and journalists and filmmakers. So I have a really good, you know, I'm getting fed a really interesting mixture of things. And So this was the starting point. And when I contacted the people behind it in, I think this must have been like late November, early December 2020, they told me, okay, this sounds interesting and we would be up to be part of your film, but you have to talk to the neuroscientists that we are working with. Because if you leave that part out, you're going to lose the essence of what the problem actually is about. And the problem is about the vulnerability of the human mind, of everybody's human mind. So it's really, it's a thing that has got to do actually with some of those evolutionary developments in our brain that gave us an edge over other animals, let's say, or other species, which was like from patterns and parts of patterns, deducting forms and intentions and being able to do predictions very fast, so that we would have an edge in terms of speed over other species when, you know, let's go back 10,000 years when we were hunters and gatherers and we would move through the woods, through the forests, and we would hear something. We would need to imagine, we would need to decipher what that, which animal or which other tribe or whatever generated that noise that we just heard, and then draw our conclusions and act accordingly. So this is really something that actually is like a big thing in the advancement of the mind, that also is the condition of some shortcomings. And the shortcomings are that we are seeing patterns where there are no patterns, actually. We are seeing faces we are seeing shapes of clouds that are just shapes of clouds, but that to some, sometimes they appear to be in the form of animals. So we see the animals, but it's just clouds. Sometimes, especially in, you know, when you've got shadows and lights and mixed up and these kind of things, we are seeing faces in inanimate objects, in trees or rocks or wherever. So that's like, this is actually a feature that people who try to decept us can play upon by feeding us incomplete patterns, but also guiding us into a direction where we would automatically complete these patterns, but read wrong forms in those patterns, and then make decisions that are based on wrong assumptions. And this is really the problem with disinformation and misinformation. I mean, the basic difference between misinformation and disinformation is some information is stored wrongly and passed on wrongly, incorrectly. Disinformation is the same thing, but on purpose. So somebody passing on wrong information on purpose. And so the way the brain works, so this is what I've learned with this neuroscientist from UCLA, is that we basically create a model of the world in our brain, and then we backcheck all the time with the real world to see if our model of the world is accurate. If we are being detached from reality, we cannot check back efficiently anymore. And that then becomes a problem, because that's when we end up in bubbles, when we end up in echo chambers. So that's something where we are becoming very vulnerable then.
You mentioned stories that seem to be artificially stitched together. And there's a lot of stories like that now, thanks to, or no thanks to, artificial intelligence efforts, particularly, you know, in Silicon Valley ChatGPT, all of the different AI programs that are widely disseminated now. Have you looked into being able to identify, you know, which ones of these are creating, you know, false narratives?
I personally have not looked into this because I was observing and accompanying with the camera the scientists who are doing this. But they actually started with some anti-vaccine myths that came out of the Bay Area, like in the early to mid 2000s, and they actually started to develop StoryMiner. I think it was around 2012 to 2013 to find out more about how these anti-vaccine stories came together. And from there, they moved on to look into Pizzagate and Bridgegate. So Pizzagate is well known. It's like this story about a pizzeria in Washington, in the outskirts of Washington, D.C., where one story was casual dining. So you had people going there to have a pizza. And that story got mixed up with a story about underground child trafficking rings and pedophilia. And then it got mixed up also with some stories about the Clinton Foundation and Democratic Party elites, the Podesta brothers. And then it also got mixed up with some satanic rituals and these kind of things. And analyzing this world of Pizzagate, the team at UCLA and UC Berkeley discovered that actually all these different parts were like narrative worlds that had nothing to do with one another, unless you managed to find a way to stitch them together. And basically you have to imagine this like as if you were having a sandwich with different slices. You know, you've got the bread, then you've got the ham, and then you've got the cheese and whatever. And then you've got a slice of bread and all stitched together with a toothstick. If you are pulling out that toothstick, everything falls apart into the individual components. And that's actually the case with these conspiracy theories. And from there, from Pizzagate, they then started following that. And of course, as Pizzagate morphed into the QAnon conspiracy theories, it became much more dangerous, much more political, and it had real-world consequences. I mean, there already was one real-world consequence with this guy driving up from, I think, North or South Carolina to free the children at this pizzeria in Washington, D.C. But then with QAnon, you suddenly had a guy who wanted to blow up the Hoover Dam, you know, and these kind of things. So that morphed into domestic terrorism, and it also morphed into actually Stop the Steal and the movement about the, and you know, these ideas from Trump and some of the Republicans about this stolen election. And of course, the thing that they discovered was also first of all, many of these stories didn't have to do anything with reality. The second thing also was the way how these stories were generated followed a certain pattern, where actually anything that happened in the world would become the cornerstone of a new conspiracy story, like a small story. And suddenly you have this web of conspiracy stories that grow together. And then on top of that, you see the formation of a real conspiracy. And that's the conspiracy that led to January the 6th and the Capitol riot, because a lot of people who were there, and I'm not talking about the Proud Boys, and I'm not talking about those, but like normal, ordinary people, a lot of people who were there genuinely believed that they were really there to save democracy. So their feedback loop system of, you know, of the model of the world that is in the mind and the real world had been cut off by relying exclusively on these online communities for information. And that's a really dangerous thing. Because if you can, and that's also something that the neuroscientists told us in the film, if you can hack the information feed, you can hack somebody's mind. And it goes very quickly, very easily. And that's the other
I've
thing.
I've heard
it can happen to everybody.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've heard a comparison of, idea that QAnon worked quite a bit like a live action role playing game, but one where people actually believed they didn't have the sense of disbelief that you normally have when you're playing a game. And it was sort of like a narrative that was constantly fed with new bits and pieces. And with each new bit and piece, and they could be very like disconnected bits and pieces, but they were finding ways to weave them together into a narrative that to most like reasonable, thoughtful persons might seem a bit absurd, but to them it was, and I still have trouble with this. I still have trouble with the fact that people can buy into a reality that seems so completely strange to me, you know. Did you ever run across that comparison to role-playing games?
Absolutely. So I had, that's an interview that did not end up in the film, but I did an interview with a live action role-play game designer. And he told me when he first came across QAnon that this was basically the kind of stuff that he was doing as a job, or I had been doing as a job. And it was really interesting to see. I mean, our brain has different levels of engagement. And if you have like an activated state of emotions, you're more engaged than if you're like cool-blooded. So if you're or cold-blooded. So if you have a fun factor built into that, and solving puzzles is fun. It's fun for our mind, for our brain. So if you've got this fun factor built in, you are more likely to believe these things, and you are more likely to kind of prioritize these things that you have just experienced to other experiences that you have in your life. And the only thing that trumps the fun factor is the fear factor. So if you've got fear built in, then of course you are triggered even more to kind of believe these things and to be emotionally involved with them. And of course, when you have this like huge international cabal of, you know, pedophiles and Satanists and all these like really evil, you know, like on a range of evildoers being in the highest range of doing evil, and to children in particular, then of course you are much more emotionally engaged. And that's something that QAnon really managed to do with these people, to keep them excited, to keep them involved. And there have been studies, I mean, I can't quote them out of top of my head, but I could look them up, because I've been reading a lot of this, of course, since 2020, when it really became a thing with the pandemic. There have been studies about the social environment of QAnon believers, and many of these people were just lonely. They were looking for community, and they found this community online. And that's also why fact-checking is not going to solve the problem, because we need to offer a lot more. If we who are having a more rational approach to information and the kind of information that should be shared around for decision-making purposes, fact-checking alone is not going to resolve this, because we need to have an emotional engagement from the people who are consuming the news and who are consuming information. And we also need to have this sense of community building. And what is really interesting, and this is what I'm showing in my film also, is the way this New York Times visual investigations team is doing their research and how they are doing their reports is that they are really, really transparent about their sources, how they come to certain conclusions. And actually, they ask their viewers to check for themselves and kind of create this lab-like environment where you can repeat the same procedures to come to the same conclusions. And interestingly, since they exist, and this is like maybe 7 years, 7 to 8 years now, they never had to retract or amend a story because it was always very clear. It was carefully done. It was not a race against time. They took the time they needed. But these were important cases. These were cases of chemical attacks against civilians in the Syrian civil war, cases of war crimes in Bucha, but also war crimes in other places in the world. And they, by being transparent about the methods, really connect with their audience. And I think in terms of journalism and if we want to have a healthy ecosystem, information ecosystem, I think that's the way to go forward. It will not work for all sorts of investigative journalism, but I think it will work for a lot of journalism to engage the viewers, to build communities, to have a level of excitement built into that, to have these ongoing conversation, to kind of break down the barrier between the producer and the consumer. And I think that's something that could actually save journalism, because the way it's now, that's not going to work for a society of the 21st century where everybody can find anything he wants independently, where the gatekeeping function has been torn down. And so, I think it's exciting times, but in a positive way, because there are so many opportunities.
I agree. Jeff Jarvis has been talking about he wrote a book called The Gutenberg Parenthesis. And he's talking about how, people were mostly conversational, but it was all very localized. And then print appeared, and the evolution of print becomes the evolution of mass media. And eventually we have media being fed from the top down, and people's thinking and opinions are being formed and shaped quite a bit from the top down. And we go through the whole era of mass media through the 20th century. And then, toward the end of the 20th century, we have the internet emerge. And that's like closing the parenthesis of the print era. And what we have then is we are back to being more conversational, and we lose the sense of authority for truth or factual authority, like the sense that the New York Times or the Washington Post are the real sources of truth. And people say, well, that's just mainstream media, and what they're starting to listen to is to each other more and more. And I think that the very smart, propaganda operatives of the former KGB that, still exist in Russia, and of course, Putin was a KGB guy, I tend to think that the Russians have had a lot to do with the way things are, the way narratives are being shaped now, especially through word of mouth, that they've learned how to leverage and feed into word of mouth. Do you think that's accurate?
Yes, absolutely. So that's also something that we don't have in the film. So I've been working with this guy. So basically, there were three guys that founded this startup that did this open source intelligence relationship graphing, metadata graphing. And I'm still in touch with one of the guys originally was featured in my film, but then he died. And then another guy who then took over the company, with him, I'm still in good contact. And we were looking into some of the things that were going on behind the scenes, but then it didn't make it into the film because it's already too long anyways. But what was interesting was the support network of Russia seamlessly merged into or morphed into the anti-COVID measure movement across Western Europe. So he was looking at Western Europe. And so this is what I saw. So this is not America, but I guess for America, it's the same. And then once the Ukraine war started, that movement seamlessly morphed into the anti-Ukraine pro-Putin network. So you have this influencer sphere behind the scenes that are really, first of all, they're having a lot of traffic. Second, they have tons of bots out there to amplify the messages. And it's possible to identify bots. I think everybody who is in that field can show you that and how it's possible. And so the first thing is, so they had this entire network behind. The second thing is they had this network of bots amplifying it. And then, of course, the really interesting thing about that is that the goal is not really to win people over towards Russia, but to sow distrust in the authorities that we have in place in our democracies, be it institutions, be it the government, be it the mainstream media. And I'm very careful with mainstream media because, especially in America, what is called mainstream media has become fringe media because so few people actually read and watch it. And the trust has eroded big time. And that's also something. If we can have, so going back to the Gutenberg parentheses, if we are going to have this conversational approach again, of talking directly to each other, what journalism has done is it has developed a set of methods and practices to make sure that we don't peddle nonsense, right? Or falsehoods. It's legally accountable if it's purposefully peddling nonsense. And I think we need to apply the same rules to everybody who is producing news. Everybody needs to start fact-checking. And say, you know, there is like the rule that you need to have at least two independent sources to prove if something's wrong or right. So you can't just rely on one source, or you can't just make it up on your own. And so that's one of the principles. And I think the problem that we are having is we have not yet transitioned from the time of top-down journalism to this colloquial thing, but we are somewhere in between. And so you have surrogate authorities that are stepping in for the traditional media authorities. So instead of the New York Times, you may have an influencer. And instead of the, I don't know, Washington Post, you may have a podcaster, which is nothing bad per se. But the thing is, we are like in a transition, in a transitional period, where we have not yet arrived at the kind of social media literacy that we need to arrive at.
Yeah, well, Donald Trump seems to be quite adept at the big lie and has been quite successful in generating a huge following just all based on falsehoods. And he's created even a media network that is reinforcing that. And I don't know how we came to that point to where just one politician could wield such power, but, you know, it keeps happening. But you'd think we would have learned, but are we ever going to learn to, you know, really critically think about who these people are and what they're saying?
Well, what shall I say as an Austrian? I mean, we've got our own history, you know, first with fascism and then with the Nazis. The same, I mean, you had fascisms all over Europe, except France, which was very close, and the UK, which was safer because of its different structure of society. And but basically you had fascist movements all over the place, and in some countries they were successful and in others not so much. I think that Donald Trump, what he really knows how to do is he knows how to communicate to people. And this has got to do with his background as a TV personality. So he was in this The Apprentice show in America, and we have similar shows in Europe. And of course, if you know how to talk, you know, how to talk this TV talk, how to be crisp and short and witty and also exaggerating, because you want to have, you know, you want to be provocative so that people wake up and don't fall asleep when you're talking. So that's really something that he knows how to do very well. And that's something that other politicians need to learn, in my opinion. So that's a form of communication. The other thing, though, is how is it possible that people, even when they know that he is lying, still buy into his stuff? And that has got to do with something totally different. That has got to do with the makeup of the American society. This is French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, which I studied some 30, 35 years ago when I was studying history. He has this model of society where you have like four poles. You've got the cultural haves and the cultural have-nots. Well, actually like this. So the cultural haves and the cultural have-nots, and you've got the economical haves and the economical have-nots. And traditionally, you had an alignment that was that the haves, the cultural haves and the economical haves would team together to preserve their power in society, and you would have the have-nots in cultural terms and the have-nots in economical terms to team up and come together to try to gain some power. But what is happening in this populist discourse is that you have somebody who is a cultural have-not, like Trump, appealing directly to cultural have-nots and also economical have-nots. But I mean, with the economical have-nots, it's not entirely true, because what he is more playing into is a middle class that's on the decline. And these are the former blue-collar workers. These are retired people. These are senior people who can't cope, you know, with the rapid advancement of technology anymore. When I did my thesis in contemporary history, it was about a mayor of Vienna around 1900. So when Vienna really was like an epicenter of arts and science and research. At the same time, we had a very dark populist movement, which created political anti-Semitism. And the kind of political discourse that was around in Vienna around 1900 inspired a young Adolf Hitler, who back then was an art student, but he was interested in politics. So he was always going to these political rallies. And this mayor of Vienna, Karl Lueger, he managed to drum up the masses. And the emperor in Austria was disgusted. So he did not hand him over the keys to the city of Vienna three times. But the fourth time he had to, because with every election, this Lueger guy was getting more votes, becoming more powerful. So eventually he did. And it was not the end of the world, but the thing that was really interesting and that interested me back then when I was studying this this historical figure was the mechanics. How did he do this? How could he be so successful? And what I discovered was, because I actually was triggered by a populist politician that we had in Austria in the mid-90s, how similar these techniques and mechanics were. So the guy that we had there as this kind of enigma that nobody knew how to deal with, he was just a copy-paste of this other guy 100 years before. And what Trump is doing is something very, very similar, and it's happening all over again and again in democracies and only in democracies, because it's a form of a political discourse within a democratic political setting. And I mean, Bernie Sanders, on the other hand, he's trying to appeal to the economic have-nots, and he's also building up the kind of scapegoat, which is the the billionaire class. What's a billionaire class? Are billionaires a class? And
I've been trying to join that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And then
I can mention something else though that was like a practice within the Republican Party that feeds into this, and it's that Republicans, I mean, I knew this because I had like a cousin who was Republican, and he sort of showed me this. They, and it was with the advent of the internet, but before that they did it in other ways, but they would share stories basically that were really pretty absurd, and that, you know, the gist of the story was something about how terrible Democrats were, or how incompetent Democrats were, or how worthless Democrats were. And these stories were never, I mean, they were demonstrably like lies or BS stories. They weren't, there was no truth to them, but they would share them with each other via email or whatever means, and they would all just kind of nod. And it was like, basically, the meaning of those things were something that they could all buy into. So when Trump, you know, makes a remark about the Democrats that's totally absurd and totally ridiculous, you still see people nodding, because it's like, well, we can agree that that's kind of what the Democrats are like, right? So truth becomes an irrelevant point in that kind of narrative sharing. You know, they're basically sharing meaning, they're not sharing fact.
Absolutely. And so this is also the problem with fact checking. It's not about the facts. People know that these falsehoods are false. What they also see is, by peddling these falsehoods, Trump is creating a community where they stick the middle finger to the, let's say, the educated class, if that's a class, but to the educated people, to people who believe in science, and trust science and scientific methods, to people who trust into, who have a trust in a rational discourse rather than an emotional discourse. And so I think if we want to win back those people, we need to look into, why are they angry? Why are they scared? So where's the fear coming from? How do they feel disempowered? How do they feel disenfranchised? And these are a lot of factors that are not in anybody's individual control. But these are societal factors. These are factors that have to do with our economy, with our economic system. They have got to do with our cultural systems. They have got to do with dynamics of demographics, like young people moving out of certain areas. And so if we want to tackle that, I think we need to take the fears and the anxieties that lie beyond seriously. I think this is really what we need to take. And I think what Hillary Clinton got totally wrong was calling them deplorables, because this added an insult to people who were already feeling fear and not being taken seriously. And what we also need to look at is, I mean, I've been to America many times in the past 10 years. And what I have seen since the pandemic, if you look at the tent cities in places like Los Angeles or San Francisco or Berkeley, even Berkeley, it's appalling for a society that these things actually happen in the richest parts of the country. And how can you put forward the argument, yes, but we've got the best economic data, like in terms of macroeconomics and the kind of, stock market prices, when you still have all this poverty visible for everybody? And I think as long as people see, or as long as people don't see the effects of any economic upturn or uptick, they will not believe them. And they have a good reason not to believe them, because it's not working for everybody. The system is broken, and it's broken in several different areas. And I think as long as the system itself is not being fixed, America will have to deal with a fair amount of anxiety and of people manipulating that anxiety. And I think, also when I first went to West Virginia, and this was not even deep into West Virginia. So this was like Maryland and Virginia and West Virginia kind of meet and up there in the mountains where we did some filming. I saw a poverty that I have not seen in 1989 when I was going to Eastern Europe for the first time after the fall of the wall. So basically the fallout of capitalism can be the same as the fallout of communism. If it's not, you need to I think we need to care more about each other. I think that's the solution. And I don't think that we need to come up always with moralistic tones and the kind of moral superiority. Because anybody can fail. Anybody can have, a bad accident. Anybody can have bad luck. But then I think as societies, we need to come together and try to help each other. It's that's like the only remedy that I have. And it's at the end of the day, I think this is what makes us human. I think this is really what makes us human. And I grew up on a family farm with a very conservative, well, by European standards, conservative background, with very religious parents, Roman Catholic, but really very, very religious. And in our village, which had, which was like, it was not far away, by American standards, it was not far, it was not spread out like in America. So it was more like kind of loosely connected houses and parts of villages that you would probably have in a suburb, or in a small town on the countryside. Everybody was talking to everybody, regardless of the political views, regardless of the religious affiliation, and regardless of age. And I think, if I have any recipe, that's my recipe. maybe in the global village, on the internet, we need to be civilized again and talk to each other instead of yelling at each other, and listen to each other instead of just broadcasting your own opinion. Most of the times when I'm also, you know, posting jokes and cartoons and this kind of stuff, and sometimes also my opinion on the web if I'm strongly opinionated. But most of the times I'm just there to read what people are writing and then dig into what kind of articles they are sharing and trying to make up my mind, because I think we can learn so much from each other, from everybody. I've made films about farmers in remote areas of the Alps, and they had wisdom. And I really appreciated what I learned from them and from what they were doing. And I had like this film with some of the top scientists in America and probably in the world in their fields. And it's equally exciting. I actually wouldn't really, kind of weigh against each other, because everybody has got to tell something.
I'm just observing that over history, there have been cases where popular leaders in countries, you know, here and in Europe, became mentally unstable. And I think we all know who they were. And in recent months, I've been reading many articles by psychiatrists and psychologists in this country observing that Donald Trump is verging upon mental breakdown. And how do you feel about how do we deal with the unstable people that have gained power? How do you deal with that?
When I was writing my thesis, I had to create a theory about populism, a theory of populism, because it didn't exist in the mid-90s. And so I had to go back to the fundamentals of democracy, like the basic ideas, the basic conceptions about humanity. And one of the things I think that made America such an, such a success story, also in terms of the political system, is that the founding fathers knew that, and that's based on the English philosophers as opposed to the French philosophers of the time, that we have good and bad inside us, all of us. And this is why we need checks and balances. So if we want to make sure that somebody as unhinged as Trump, and I also question his sanity, if somebody like him comes to power, there needs to be checks and balances. And I think throughout the American system, which is very much a bottom-up system and not a top-down system, Europe is very much a top-down system, I have a lot of trust in the makeup of American democracy of being bottom-up. Because you elect everything, you know, like every major role in the administration, and being from the school board to the sheriff to wherever, you know. And so I think that's the recipe to deal with it. But then on the other hand, I think the media has already gotten into Trump's trap in 2016 by giving him all this free airtime, only to make money. And I think they are doing it again. that's how stupid can you be, really? Yes,
I've got to order one of those Trump Bibles.
For instance, I bet he never read it.
And I think you're right.
I think his sneakers, you know, his golden sneakers. Jesus Christ. But but
you know, so there's the thing, there's an
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, there's another question I really have been wanting to ask you, but go ahead and finish, and then I'll ask.
No, so The thing is, I do believe in checks and balances. And I think as long as those are in place, that's the way forward. And yes, you've got a problem with the Supreme Court because Democratic administrations didn't pay enough attention. You know, some of the Democratic people could have retired at the Supreme Court to be replaced. And earlier, because it's not, doesn't say that you need to be there until you're like totally, you know, 120 or so. I didn't like much, as a Catholic, I didn't like much the German Pope, but the thing that he did right was retire when he was feeling too old. And I think that's the kind of thing that people do when they're getting too old, you know. Yeah. See, you don't have the capacity anymore. I think what the media does wrong is it makes it the duel of two people, because we are so used to that from all the drama that we are seeing on screen and on the streamers and everywhere. It's always this sort of duel, and it's not. If it's any duel, then it's a duel between teams. And if I look at the team Biden, I see Blinken, who is brilliant. I see Jake Sullivan, who is brilliant. Who is even remotely comparable to those on Team Trump? There's no one, you know? So if people are not happy with Biden's age, well, yeah, but it's a teamwork. Governance is a teamwork. And he has got brilliant people on his team.
Yeah, and he's a really effective leader, regardless of what some people say, and I actually think that he understands some of the things we've been talking about. I mean, he tries to speak to the people with respect, you know, and he makes it very clear that his issue is Trump, and he's been pretty forceful in his comments about Trump too. It's pretty good, but. But this other thing I was saying, I wanted to ask you, because I noticed it quite a bit and watch it. Your film is a very beautiful film. I mean, it's not just the content that is so striking. And so, I mean, after watching your film, you can't help but have a much better understanding of the information wars, I guess would be one way to characterize it. But there are parts of your film where you film people, some of the people that you're interviewing or that you're talking to are in very natural settings, like Vuani in Grand Canyon, that sort of thing. And I was kind of just wondering about that, why you made that choice to use natural settings, or when the neurologist is talking about how the brain works, you're showing a forest. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. So I wanted to show use metaphors to show the importance and the relevance, and to also put people in these places. So when Vuani is at the edge of the Grand Canyon at sunset and talks about the magnitude of information that's being unleashed on us, and the velocity, and the kind of really, so much larger than human dimension of that, I want people to experience this so much larger than human dimension themselves. When I'm talking about our brain being this pattern detection and completion and prediction machine, I wanted to fly through a forest to give people the sensation that they are actually trying to detect patterns, complete them, and try to do predictions of what's coming next, to put them in this place, because I think it makes a much stronger audiovisual experience if you can witness this kind of stuff on your own, even as it's being explained to you. And I mean, the biggest work on this film was not the filming, it was the editing. And the film is still too long. So the version that I was showing at South by Southwest was 135 minutes, and that's definitely too long. So we have to cut that down. But it's so bloody hard to bring something together that's in itself is very complicated. So the kind of investigative journalism that the New York Times is doing and the guys at the ICIJ are doing is already very complicated. Then you've got the neuroscience part, which is the most complicated part. And then you even have a software that's also complicated to explain what it actually does and how they do it and how they came to actually develop it. And to narrow that down to sizable and understandable portions, this was a really big feat by the editors that I was working with. And as you have seen, we're still not quite, so we are quite there, but we are not yet there. So we need to size it down to make it even more, to even make it easier, comprehensible for the average person. Because at the end of the day, even if it is a complicated topic, I try to reach the average people, you know, people who are interested. And there are a lot of people who are interested. And I don't fear for journalism or any sort of journalistic, work, because documentary is of sort, it's the marriage between journalism and film. So I don't fear, as long as there is a hunger, and there really is a hunger by the audience for this kind of content. And the same goes for podcasts, the same goes for long-form journalism. So just like a week ago, so The Atlantic reported that they are in the positive with $100 million of revenue after years of losses. Would anybody say that The Atlantic is easy to understand and easy to read? No, it's not. But it's so well written, it's so well researched. And for me, it has become, over the past years, it has become my go-to medium for many things, because, you know, there is like the kind of flimsy, quick information, but I can get this information from, I mean, I'm not on Twitter, but any of my social media, because basically that's just headlines trying to trigger something. And if I'm interested, I then start digging. But if I want to really be informed about something, I turn to The Atlantic, and it's profitable. So it's showing that this kind of stuff works. And I have seen it with this journalist, this Austrian journalist that I have in my film, who was fired by he left this magazine that he had been working for 25 years, or almost 25 years. And now he started a podcast, an investigative podcast. And now he has double the traffic per month than the magazine that he had worked for. So there is an audience. There is always,
oh, that's fantastic.
People are curious by nature. They always want to know things. And that's it. That's we just need to serve it to them in a way that they can consume it.
We're kind of at the end of our hour. I did want to ask you if you have a release date yet.
We don't have a fixed release date, but we aim at September.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much, Fritz, for joining us today. This has been an excellent conversation.
Thanks.
And we hope to talk to you again.
We would love to have you back after the film is out and get some more updates on what you found.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, John and Scoop.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.